Good afternoon, good evening, good morning. My name is Richard Thomas, and I'm in conversation this afternoon with Aura Satz, an artist and writer who's recently produced a sound installation or installed a sound installation at Beaconsfield. More about how to get there and where it is and so on shortly. But the installation is called Glissolalia, and ostensibly then Glissolalia. I don't know why I'm struggling with that. Explores auditory illusion, I suppose. Something that's sort of seldom explored or discussed, as far as I know, compared to, say, optical illusion and so on. Could you?
Yes. Well, the starting point was really Beaconsfield approached me. They do an annual sound commission called Soundtrap, and this is the third one. And they approached me partly, I think, because I'd just done a film called Automa Music, which was all around early musical automata and kind of uncanny qualities of lack of agency in sound production. And so they invited me to the space, and as you know, the upper space of Beaconsfield Gallery has this amazing resonance. It's quite a beautiful venue. It's an old ragged school.
Mm.
And I think it was a girls' school beforehand. And so it has this kind of slope, and then there's this very small window at the top, and you can see a train going by, and it's just quite an unusual space, and it has a 7-second echo.
Mm.
And I'd always been really attracted by certain sounds, such as the theremin. I've had quite a long obsession with the theremin, and also the musical saw, and also certain kinds of singing, of close harmony, a cappella or barbershop singing. And so I tried to think around something that could fit in that space using those components. And then I came across the shepherd tone, which is an acoustic illusion. And I'd been working a lot with illusions, more visual illusions and kind of illusions that are related to body image. I did another project that was all around phantom limbs and phantasmagoria that can be embodied and experienced. And so when I found this acoustic illusion, which basically consists of the juxtaposition of 8 scales, and if the first one ends where the last one starts, I hope that made sense, you get this effect of a endlessly rising tone or endlessly descending tone. And so that was the starting point, this acoustic illusion, which was very fitting with the kind of work that I do, more from a visual perspective, but it was a kind of quite a nice way in for me into a sound piece.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I suppose you should qualify what a shepherd tone is, really. And it was something that was developed at Bell Laboratories in the 60s, I think, or 50s, I can't remember, by a guy called Roger Shepherd. And as you say, it's a, correct me if I'm wrong, a rising and descending tone that you experience simultaneously. But in fact, it isn't moving anywhere at all. It's just a constant tone, yeah?
Yeah, I mean, Roger Shepherd did a kind of an electronic version using sine waves separated by octaves. And it can go either up or down. And it sounds a little bit like an aeroplane or sci-fi kind of sound, where it just seems to go, but then it goes on and on and on. And you can't, as you listen carefully, you can't hear the beginning and the end, but the illusion is that it's continuously rising or continuously descending. And so in the piece, we played with that. The starting point to create that effect was actually using some test tone records that were provided to me by Alex Kolkowski, who was one of the collaborators in the piece, from his gramophone collection. So they're kind of old test tone recordings, and basically the installation has 8 speakers, 8 separate tracks, and so each track starts with a slight delay. And so you get this vortex of test tone records spiraling in the space, and this added effect of a kind of endlessly rising tone, or at another point endlessly descending, but it's actually doing so in a very dynamic way, so that it's sculptural and architectural. It's really kind of twisting in the space. It's a shame, because you can't really do it justice with a stereo recording, as we will be playing later on in the show, because it is actually very dynamic, and it's like quite extreme surround sound, you know, rather than five.
Have you attempted to do a surround sound recording?
Yeah, we have.
Okay.
What we're playing later on is actually recorded with a surround microphone, but it's a stereo recording.
Okay. Yeah.
But I mean, you do hear it, but it doesn't really feel the same way as it does when you're in the space and you get this real sense of when it's going down, you're kind of being grounded and you're digging a hole almost. You're kind of going down the rabbit hole of Alice in Wonderland. And then when it goes up, it's like you're soaring really high. So you really feel like you're inhabiting the architectural space of Beaconsfield Gallery. It's very visceral in the way it affects you.
I mean, one thing that struck me, I imagine in the center of this construction of speakers and so on, the air must be changing quite considerably. The air must be warmer, I would imagine, because there's much more activity there sonically, which I thought was kind of interesting. That it's not visible, but there must be something going on with the with air currents in that area if you've got such a concentration of frequencies.
Yeah, I mean, I like the idea of. I mean, it is all about disembodied sound, but it of course re-embodies it in the listener, but also because all of the instruments that were chosen, which are from the test tones. Maybe I should explain a bit how that came about. But basically, the test tones provide this initial score, which is the shepherd's tone. And then I invited three other layerings, as it were, of musicians and singers to respond. The first being Alex Kolkowski, who plays the musical saw. And so he kind of echoes the shepherd's tone with the musical saw, and it blends quite seamlessly. And then it becomes something else. It kind of has this slightly nostalgic, almost pathetic feel at some points, and it kind of feels like these kind of sighing voices. And then the musical saw blends in with the theremin, which is played by Lydia Kavina, who is a virtuoso of the theremin. And her piece, again, is very... initially, it's just like a rising tone. That's the kind of... the compositional structure that we used was kind of rising and descending tones. That was a very simple starting point. And so she then creates a kind of vibrato shepherd's tone, and that feels almost like fireworks. It's quite explosive. And then it turns into a melody, an eight-piece harmony. And then that merges with the human voice, which is the last component, and that is a barbershop quartet named Hunky Dory. They're all female barbershop quartet from Caterham. So I essentially asked each of these components to respond to a composition. And so again, it kind of merges, it bleeds, the sections bleed into one another.
Can I ask you about that a minute? Why are you interested in that? Why are you interested in dovetailing these things in? So I suppose it is to further subvert expectation that you initially think this is a theremin, and in fact it's a saw. I mean, what are you asking people to question it, to you know, scrutinize their value judgments about what they know music or sound to be and so on? I just wondered where this kind of cross-fertilization thing comes from.
Well, the reason I was interested in these different sound qualities is because they have this uncanny vocal tendency, so that the saw sounds sometimes like a soprano, sometimes like a whistle. It's kind of quite high, but it could be human, but then, you know, it's not, especially when you hear the attack of the bow hitting the saw. It kind of subverts that sense of it being human, but actually it's not. And the theremin similarly sounds very much like a human voice, but it's as if the resounding box isn't in the mouth, it's somewhere else. It's like it's coming from a lower part of almost like the stomach or something. And all of those instruments had these qualities, had this kind of human but not human sound that I really liked. And so I like the fact that you could blend one into the other in a very seamless way, which is almost as though it's a kind of endless coiling or spiraling of one into the other and one upon the other. And the piece is essentially all vowels. It's all kind of open tones that follow from one another without any real breaks. There's no consonant quality. And I worked very specifically with the barbershop singers not to do the kind of boo-wop, doo-wop kind of, you know, that they quite like, and to keep it all as continuous, because in that way you can glide, you can do a glissando from one note to another with this continuous mm-hmm. quality, whereas something like the piano or the film that I did, which is all on mechanical music, is all about this breaking, clanky consonant quality, and this one was very much about this continuous rising up or falling down, and it's very it is very, I mean, I kind of hesitate to use the word uncanny or haunted or ghostly, but I was quite interested in that quality because it has this element of the pathetic and the humorous and the embodied and the disembodied all at the same time, and in terms of verticality, I mean, I was very much taken by that space, and because it has this descent. I mean, I don't know if you're familiar with that kind of. It's like, it's not exactly steps. It's like
a it's a gradient. It's a very strong, unusual gradient. That's I don't quite understand why it's there, but it's a very pleasant experience to be there. Actually,
I think it might have been because the teacher would probably have been in the lower section, and the students.
So it's almost like a lecture, a kind of scenario.
Yeah,
I would imagine.
I think so. I'm not sure. But that really struck me as an architectural component, and the way that I was using sound seemed to echo that slight descent or slight rising. And so the speakers are placed in a circle. Eight speakers are placed in a circle, and because of this the fact that the floor's not level, you get this strange kind of spiral effect, because it's not a proper circle. It's a circle that's on a bit of an oval angle.
I see.
This kind of
so there's not quite equilibrium there within the instrumentalists, if we can call them that. Yeah.
So what you end up hearing is, say, a high note. I mean, I did actually divide the sound so that the higher notes were at the higher end of the room and the lower notes were at the end.
There is a kind of a consonant, in a sense. So you have this oscillation, but is more dominant or less dominant at a certain point in a 360-degree radius.
Yes.
So you could possibly say that it's a kind of... you know, like a clock that is stuck.
Yeah.
Not
although
quite.
Although it's more of a spiral.
Okay. Yeah, all right. Yeah, well, very interesting. I mean... Of course, synesthesia and so on, you're interested in phantom limb syndrome and this kind of a thing. I mean, this must also inform how you engage with things like audio illusion and so on. And is that true?
Yeah, I mean, the image that featured on the invite to the Beaconsfield exhibition is actually a visual illusion, and it's a bit like the barber's pole. So it's a series of stripes, and when you turn them, when it's rotating, you get this effect of a spiral that is endlessly coming towards you.
It's like the Duchamp rotor reliefs.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And that served as a visual score for the composition. It very much informed my thinking around this idea of a kind of illusion that draws you in, sucks you in, and spews you out at the same time, and you're kind of soaring with it, and then you're thrown out of it. And so it's very much about embodied phenomenological experience of sound.
If people want to go along and see this, they can go to Beaconsfield, which is on 22 Newport Street in Vauxhall. That's in London, SE11. I suppose the nearest tube is Vauxhall. Mind you have a choice. You go to Vauxhall, Tube, Lambeth North, or Waterloo, indeed. There's a substantial number of buses that go there. If you want to call them up and reserve a space or whatever it is, it is 0207-582-6465. And the website is beaconsfield.ltd.uk. Soundtrack free, Arasats, Glossolalia. How do I pronounce that again? I'm sorry, I've been so crap with that. But
well, you know, glossolalia is the speaking in
yes,
tongues.
Yes, yeah.
So that was the inspiration, the combination of glissando and glossolalia. So glissolalia sounds about right.
So that's a kind of neologism, talking of speaking in tongues and so on. Yeah. Well, it sounds like a really intriguing project, and I believe you have some other stuff coming up in the not too distant future. Is that correct?
Yes. Well, concurrently, there's an exhibition on at Art Project Space, which is near Knightsbridge. It's a gallery opened by David Grin, who runs a series of artist film projects. And it's the film I was mentioning before on musical automata.
Mm.
And essentially, I suppose it's the kind of the partner piece to Glossolalia, in that when I was working on automa music, which was all around these quite amazing, not just pianolas, but they're more complicated orchestra versions called orchestrions and so forth. And this idea of that moment in history in which sound is detaching from its source, and you get this real kind of visualization of how choreographically you might actually see the sound, but of course there's no one playing it, but you see the sound source, and you get this real sense of there's a kind of historical detaching happening just before the invention of the gramophone. And so that interest in the visual aspect of sound detaching from its source led to Glossolalia, where sound is very much disembodied, but of course it keeps being re-embodied in the sense of you keep thinking it somehow clinging on to a human quality of sorts.
This disembodiment is an interesting idea. Do you think that's something that you're sort of preoccupied with? Yeah,
very much. I mean, I can't pinpoint the exact reason why this attracts me so much, but I find I'm constantly working around areas of disembodiment, and I suppose it's because I find it quite fascinating that somehow through breaking, in the case of sound and source, or kind of disembodying it still remains very much rooted, and you get this strong sense of it kind of resists completely floating away somehow. The piece I did on Phantom Limbs that you were mentioning before was all about enabling a spectator or participant to feel this sense of displacement, or of the body somehow being a phantom body, you know, instilling a sense of doubt or of question. And I quite like that. I quite like the possibility of instilling that in an audience.
Well, look, I hope you do, and to substantial members of them, I highly recommend get down to Beaconsfield, 22 Newport Street, Vauxhall, London, go to beaconsfield.ltd.uk. Aura, thank you very much.
To resound is to sound again, to carry on sounding. Resonance is then the characteristic catachresis of our strange, resounding time, in which time can no longer be counted on to pass as it used to. Sound is time's skin-tight silhouette, for there is no sound that persists, no sound whose outline is not drawn out in and drawn out of time. But in resounding, the twinning of time and sound is loosened, and sound starts to fill space. Resounding is the holding back or the spreading out of time, transforming it from a taut line into a lazy, doodled pool or slowly loitering lasso. In resounding, time seems to coagulate into a sort of pseudo-matter, vapid, viscous, or oily, that swells and shivers rather than advancing in any particular direction. But to resound is not entirely to set time at naught, for resounding is as mind with motion as any other kind or quality of sound. To resound is only to last out, to put off passing away, to subsist as a mode of desisting, delay in decaying, to die away in delay. And indeed all sounding already has resonance lingering in it, for a sound is nothing but an oscillation, a rocking back and forth that riddles and dilates simple passing away. Resonance requires interiority, or, in its absence, requisitions it. A desert gives back no echoes. Sound, the nature of which is to propagate outwards from its point of origin, can only be bent back in its tracks by some form of obstruction or limit. Echolocation is only of use within some locality. To sound, and even more to resound, is to sound in and thereby to sound out such a locality, to draw out the audible map of what baffles the indifferent dissipation of sound and thereby lets it persist in brief self-interfering. Murray Schafer suggests that the qualities of European music are defined largely by the fact that music has progressively been designed to be played and heard indoors, that European music is all, in fact, chamber music. But this could be turned inside out. Perhaps music, which is anyway only another name for sound that has been brought back on itself, turning elapsing into pattern, occurrence into quasi-object, provides the condition for all forms of enclosure and introversion. Every piece of music is a music box. It makes room for itself. The primary form of all life, the cell, is just this kind of eddying or introversion, which resists flow by rooting flow back into itself, creating a living room, a temporary space of reprieve from the otherwise irreversible onward slide into entropy. Life is hesitation, standing aside, suspended sentience. A room in which all reverberation has been damped down seems alien and isolating, for such a room has thereby been rendered stone deaf to us and to itself. Let's remember, though, that stones are not in fact deaf at all, but sharply, sparklingly resonant. Counterintuition, soft, compliant or moist substances, human bodies, for example, amorously soak up sound, but thereby annul it. It is the obdurate substance, stone, wood, crystal, which, by resisting sound, rings and responds to it, giving it back to itself, completing it by rebuffing and doubling it. A warm, responsive place damps sound off. Only hard, dry places can give mellowness and body to sound. Cold flint is needed to strike a spark. This resorting of a space to itself can seem to give to space a kind of reflexivity, creating the beginnings of proprioception. A room or other resonant enclosure that is rich in echoes seems not only to answer back, it seems also to be able to hear or overhear itself. Its resounding is a kind of self-reflection. Its reverberations make rumour of itself. What sound engineers call room tone is the quality possessed by a particular space of being able to listen to itself, to revolve and ruminate on sound in the intramural murmur of wall to wall. Gerard Manley Hopkins compares the inscape or expressive essence of things to the ringing of bells. Things, he says, give out their being as each hung bell's bow swung finds tongue to fling out broad its name. Bells have indeed often been given names, Haute Claire, Doucement, Great Tom, Big Ben, and sometimes even baptized. But the capacity of bells to announce their own names, as well as their privileged role in acts of ceremonial annunciation of all kinds, depends upon the fact that their sound is first internally wound up or multiplied on itself inside the secret throat of the bell's chamber, reculé pour mieux sauter. Language suggests that sounding must precede resounding, but a bell, like any instrument that has a resonating chamber, must first internally resound before it can sound itself out, out loud. When I hear my own recorded voice, I recoil, as everyone does from theirs, from its shrillness, its parched ugliness. The recorded voice is a shriveled changeling, a skinned lizard usurping the place of the full-bodied phantasmal organism that ordinarily occupies our heads, amplified and fattened by the bones of the skull. Not only is resonance in itself a kind of incipient selfhood, selfhood is a reflux of resonance, every ego an echo. The way to rehabilitate this disowned, desiccated thing is to add echo to it. A recorded voice envolumed with reverberation, I can acknowledge mine. By being doubled, it is made our own again, enlarged, recharged, enchanted, adored. Aura Satz's glissolalia provides an enactment of evicted sound seeking to come home to itself. Theremin players, having no frets or other articulations of the air to help them pick out their starting pitches, must rely on their own postural memories, fine-tuned by a process known as pitch fishing, a tentative miniature trial and error by indirections finding directions out. Like a radio listener scanning the waveband for a station, the writer casting for a rhyme, the fly zigzagging to pick up a wisp of rot or sweetness in the air, a singer probing for the right register in which to pitch her song, the accompanist striving to fit his fingers in the sockets of what is sounding in his ears, glissolalia's parabolas of rising and falling tones sound as though something, perhaps it's us, were trying to get into a groove, to tune up or tune in. Glissolalia seems to function by echolocation, the sending out of sounds to pick up whispers of a place and its place in it, like the whisker that is an index of the cat's own width. Resonance is not just time put on the spot, not just the hiccup or dimpling of space, for it involves more than simple self-relation. Resonance is also that which sets aside and moves across monadic pockets of introversion. Resonance can therefore seem reparative, a rejoining of what space has arbitrarily or violently set asunder. Resonance is a work of communication in the literal sense of a making common. A note plucked on one lute will cause another unplucked lute in the vicinity to thrill faintly in sympathy. Sing into an open piano, and certain strings will give back buzzing assent to your voice. Resonance is therefore to be understood not as conduction, but as induction, not as effect, but as affinity. The note doesn't seem to have travelled from one instrument to another. It's rather as if the same note sleeping inside the two instruments had been awoken at the same moment. A resonant world is one implicated with itself, in the sense in which particles subject to what Einstein described as spooky action at a distance are said to exhibit quantum entanglement, so that a change in the state of one can affect the other, even though they may be light years apart. Resonance discloses a magical economy of inductions, in place of the more familiar economy of productions. Instead of the effort, calculation and hard bargaining required to produce mechanical effects in the material world, resonance seems to offer something for as good as nothing. It takes much more energy to set a pendulum swinging than it does to amplify that swing by timely nudges on the beat of its oscillations.
Thank you.
Glissolalia is a choreography of such rhymes and chimes and affinities. Looming and receding, the resonance and resemblance of sounds with each other in space, here comes to enact a resonance or rhyming of sound with space. The arcs and swags of sound, rising and falling like scales, sirens, fans or engines, graph in the air or in the ear, the parabolas that sound itself may be made to insinuate in sand, water and wax, as well as the sine curves made visible by the oscilloscope. Nothing here is quite itself. All is ghosting, surrogacy and vicariance, mirror on mirror mirrored, everything loaning and borrowing being to and from the never quite isomorphic forms that come and go about it. We are sympathetic to ideas of sympathy, but there is more than community and meeting of minds in resonance, which can also be murderous. The soprano whose smithereens a glass by hitting on its resonant frequency induces in it a catastrophic apoptosis or suicide by self-agitation. The wind buffeting a bridge at a frequency that locks step with its secret note of disaster can make it buck and writhe in spasm. Truly, resonance can lend a lethal vitality to death. The gratuity of resonance is what leads to its darker, more demonic aspect, for the self-propagation of resonance is the engine also of the cyclone and the tsunami, the scandal and the stampede, the avalanche, earthquake and epidemic. In such cases, when undulation enlarges into inundation, the internally resonating enclave expatiates, the inside engrosses its outside, broadcasting to all quarters the howl of its feedback. For this reason, the soaring and swooping glissandi of glissolalia continually deflect or seek to defect from the convergence towards which they seem to tend. There must be some dissonance, shortfall, or overshoot. Amid this structure in which nothing stays long enough in one place to become separate, there must be nevertheless a kind of discretion. The 21-minute loop of glissolalia creeps up on, but never quite comes back to, itself. Perhaps it keeps itself from itself to keep at bay that coming together that might shiver it and us apart.
Listening just now for echoes and for the echo effects that Renaissance poets and musicians came most happily upon. Echoes are a genus of soundbite related to diminuendo, where some syllables fall away and others assume a surpassing resilience. Echo effects exaggerated the temperamental timeliness of echoes, repeating and recombining end syllables into remonstrance, irony, or affirmation, while prodding monologue into dialogue. Through echoes and literary echo effects, early moderns registered the displacement of sound and found themselves coming upon noise at every turn. Echoes, though they too relied upon a pattern of call and response, were hardly respectful of person, sequence, or conclusion, arriving from unknown quarters in overlapping snatches and tailing refrains. They did not share the full simultaneity of fama or gallimaufry of words on every mouth, but moved to a rhythm of their own, interjecting, rupting. Once a noisy nymph, wrote Ovid, who never held her tongue when others spoke, who never spoke till others had begun, and who by her chatter delays Hera from catching her husband Zeus in flagrante delicto with any number of nymphs. Echo has been cursed by the goddess so that she can only repeat words spoken by others. Woman as antiphon, a respondent chorus and despondent recording. Falling eyes over ears for a gorgeous youth, she must wait to make her passion known to him through his own words, as he loses track of his hunting companions and halloos into the wild. Anyone here? Close by, but hidden in the woods, Echo can at last declare herself. Here? Come on over here, shouts the youth. Echo, over here. No, he insists, join me. At this mistaken invitation, Echo runs to throw her arms around him. Join me. But he is, after all, Narcissus and denies her. Hands off, I'd rather die than have you hold me. Hold me, Echo must call out as she is spurned. As she turns away, hold me, to burn with love in lonely caves, old me, languishing, her body kerneling to the sternness of bone, and finally to voice alone, old me, untouched and intangible. Narcissus himself will languish and perish for love of an untouchable twin, watery vision and mirror self, optical inverse of the audible fable of Echo. Echo, whom Ovid places by the woodland pool, looking on invisibly as Narcissus, fatally attracted to so lovely a reflection, and anorexic with frustration, breathes a barely audible farewell. Farewell, murmurs Echo, moving on, restless and fully vocal. Unlike silent, immobile Narcissus, and my obligation, legation here, ear, is to her shards of sound, hard sound, making half and therefore new sense of what reaches her, asking us to listen again to words no longer our own. Poets of the 15th, 16th, and 17th centuries had Echo waiting on maskers, melancholics, warriors, and lovers to get her words in edgewise. No, edgewise. I am a voice without the body's aid, when all the tale is told and sentence said, that I recite the latter words afresh in mocking sort and counterfeiting wise. Mocking and counterfeiting, Echo shifts the rounds of discourse, co-responding from unseen places, even as she holds to nubs of sound, her antiphonies the ultimate precy, hearts of our natter. Erasmus invokes her in his dialogues, monastic novitiate, but it's wretched for a lad to live without a lass. Echo, alas. Novitiate, what do you think of most modern monks, eh? Echo, monkeys. Impatient with circumlocutions, with words that do not touch her, Echo repeats only what bears repeating, askew, yet pointed and personal. Stepped up a notch during the 1550s from name and noun to English verb, Echo actively intervenes. More than sound, the Greek eche, in her boldness and bodilessness, Echo comes to bespeak a cultural physics of noise that will redound as interference, feedback, compression, stochastic resonance. Forward and afterward, she muffles, intensifies, truncates, and distends, each process leaning toward a different sensibility. Echo muffling, nostalgia, ironic loss. Tumult all around, will you be able to babble? Echo intensifying, exaggeration, focused repetition. Our holy leaves, the echo then of bliss, yes, yes, yes. Echo truncating, immediacy, sudden relevance. Echo, what shall I do to my nymph when I go to behold her, hold her? Echo distending, anticipation, wry recapitulation. Flint all over, a lover. Muffling, intensifying, truncating, distending, delaying, Echo stands in perpetual indenture to our soundfulness. Without us, she's mute. That, of course, was the curse. But the curse reverses. The more dynamic we imagine her in response to us, whether ironic, prophetic, obstreperous, intimate, or admonitory, the more decisive is her redirection. Oh, who will show me those delights on high? Aye. So Echo in her various capacities will lead us on, much as she has led one modern poet scholar, John Hollander, to claim without qualm that a certain amount of echoing overhang is necessary in every actual human acoustical situation in order to avoid a sense of sound death. That would seem to be an eloquent recasting of recent textbooks on speech science. The impulse toward such a claim, framed so squarely in mortal and spatial terms, is much older, stemming from early modern notions of the liveliness and ubiquity of echo. Neither Ovid nor his first Renaissance interpreters focused on echo's ubiquity. If Ovid was the first to twine echo with Narcissus, Ovid's references were bound to Boeotian woodland, the legendary home of Narcissus northwest of Athens. Almost as afterthought did Ovid's phantom sound and nodding daffodil Narcissus pseudo-Narcissus spread beyond this pale. There was, however, another competing story that drew its pathos from echo's everywhereness, one that joined echo not with coldly beautiful Narcissus, but with hot, horned Pan. Pan, the player of pipes and lover of merry noise. Pan, the pal of Dionysus and source of panic. Pan, the ever-lecherous, who tries to seduce Echo, the virtuous nymph, who rejects his advances. Humiliated, the goat-foot demigod saddened a madness among the shepherds and goatherds, and they, in a desperate fury like so many dogs and wolves, tore Echo all to pieces and flung about them all over the world her yet singing limbs. While Ovid in the first century gave us a dwindling temporal echo who takes up our words to return them surprisingly reconsidered, Longus in the second century bequeathed a ubiquitous echo who takes up our worlds ready to surprise us at every turn. Really, the two poetic strands are complementary. Echo carries with her the prospect of sound displaced, uprooted, multiple, abbreviated, translocated, and the displacement of sound at every prospect. Pining for Narcissus, Ovid's echo withers to a genius loci, the spirit of a desolate place who, melancholy or bitter or preoccupied, distorts. Fleeing Pan, Longus's defiant echo is scattered so widely that she expands into the spirit of every place, pure and singing. Through the efforts of Renaissance Neoplatonists, echo with her yet singing limbs became grace itself in the form of song, which was, according to Marsilio Ficino in 1489, a most powerful imitator of all things. And when it imitates the celestials, it also wonderfully arouses our spirit upwards to the celestial influence, and the celestial influence downwards to our spirit.